Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for the Jerry and Paula Show with your hosts, Jerry Williams and Paul Alexander. Your first host from Cincinnati, Ohio, and a former police officer, let's give a round of applause for the one and only Jerry Williams.
I am a Western chauvinist.
I'm a Western chauvinist!
I refuse to apologize.
I refuse to apologize!
For creating the modern world.
For creating the modern world!
This is the Proud Boys Oath. Saying it out loud is the first step towards joining the right-wing extremist group.
And you have to believe that the West is the best. That Western civilization is the best civilization on Earth. And it's something that you cherish.
Enrique Tarrio is the Proud Boys' current leader, and over the past 4 years, he's seen the group grow from a few guys in a bar to thousands of members across the United States. They've been labeled a hate group. The FBI says they have ties to white nationalism. And on January 6th, they joined armed Trump supporters in an insurrection at the Capitol.
I would say the Proud Boys are one of the most dangerous extremist organizations in America.
But for members of a fringe organization, the Proud Boys have done a pretty good job of inserting themselves into mainstream American politics. So how did a group of right-wing extremists rise to the main stage of American politics to become the president's self-appointed defenders? And will they fall under a new administration?
Go home to mommy! Go home to mommy!
You'll be a punishment.
No, go home to mommy!
Insider recorded an exclusive interview with Enrique Tarrio, the leader of the Proud Boys.
I've kind of always been a Proud Boy. I've always had these values, and I wasn't a group guy. Like, I've been an activist for 18 years, but I've never joined a group, you know? And I decided to join this one because it was a little different. It was based on comedy. It's based on fun.
It all started with a guy named Gavin McInnes. He's been a big media personality since the 1990s. He actually co-founded Vice Media. But these days, he's more famous for making racist, sexist, and all kinds of other offensive remarks on his streaming show.
I think my favorite monkey has to be Barack Obama.
Here's the deal, dude. I am a total fervent racist. But I married an Indian because I'm cleaning up the racist.
Back in 2008, McInnes left Vice because of creative differences. His views started to get more and more extreme. And in 2015, he founded the Proud Boys.
I'll make you proud, boy.
That song is from the musical Aladdin.
I'll make you proud of your boy.
And that sort of is the moral of the Proud Boys, where we seem like pussies, we're named after a Broadway show tune, we wear black and yellow, Fred Perry's, but we'll murder you. We will kill you. Because we're full of hate. We want to make America hate again.
And this is where you might notice Gavin McInnes sounding, in a way, like someone else you know.
We will make America proud again. We will make America safe again. And yes, together, we will make America great again.
Since the Trump presidency began, these groups are kind of emboldened by Trump's rhetoric to kind of get out there and be more in the mainstream.
Rachel E. Greenspan covers far-right extremism for Insider. She says Donald Trump opened the doors for a group of men who felt like society had wronged and emasculated them. And then Gavin McInnes took things one step further. He gave these men a purpose and a name.
You know the most dangerous gangs? They have names like the Crybabies and the Mama's Boys. That's who we are. We're the Proud Boys.
And something that was a joke isn't so much of a joke anymore, is it?
USA! 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 USA!
By 2016, McInnes's gang of Proud Boys had turned into a real organization with a set of rules. To join, you had to take the Proud Boys oath,
which is, I am a Western chauvinist.
I am a Western chauvinist!
And I refuse to apologize.
And I refuse to apologize!
For creating the modern world.
For creating the modern world!
Ex Experts who study extremism say West could be interpreted as code for white, and some current and former Proud Boys have documented ties to white supremacist groups. Tario, who's Cuban American, says he's proof that's not true.
We're not white supremacists.
But you have admitted in the past that the group has attracted some members who hold white supremacist views.
Yes. You know why? If the media is constantly saying these guys are white supremacists, a white supremacist sees this and is like, oh, you know what? I have a home here. But the truth is that they don't.
In the context of Proud Boys, they will say, we are really just misunderstood. The media has us wrong. This is how I came to understand the group.
Samantha Kuttner studies the Proud Boys and how they recruit. As part of that, she's talked to dozens of current and former members, and she's noticed an important pattern. When you call them out, the Proud Boys say they're not extremist. They're not a hate group.
Proud Boys is a patriot club. Actually, no, I'm sorry. A drinking club with a patriot problem instead of the other way around.
They are not a fraternal drinking organization. They are a radicalization vector. There are arrests. There is violence. These are things that you can't deny.
By 2017, the Proud Boys were earning a reputation, not as a harmless boys club, but for showing up as self-declared bodyguards at Trump rallies around the country. Some wore helmets and brought weapons. The police made arrests. Meanwhile, some people thought President Trump was encouraging that kind of behavior among his supporters.
Any guy that can do a body slam, he's my kind. He's my guy.
And then, in August 2017, the Proud Boys became explicitly linked to violent extremism. A group of white nationalists organized a rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. The mastermind was Jason Kessler, a member of the Proud Boys.
Do y'all have a problem with an uppity white person who's proud of who they are?
Some Proud Boys marched along with neo-Nazis and other members of the alt-right. You could hear them chanting,
"You will not replace us! You will not replace us!"
Fights broke out with counter-protesters, and one of them, Heather Heyer, was killed in a car attack. Charlottesville made national news. In a press conference, President Trump said,
"I think there's blame on both sides. You look at..."
Almost immediately, Gavin McInnes and the Proud Boys started to walk back their involvement. McInnes kicked Jason Kessler out of the group.
"Gavin, I know you're going to see this. Be proud of your boys, man."
Enrique Tarrio denies Kessler was even ever a member of the Proud Boys.
Jason Kessler showed up to a vetting meetup and... this was before Charlottesville, and he was denied membership.
But Insider obtained video of Jason Kessler reciting the Proud Boys' oath, the first step towards joining the group.
"I'm a proud Western chauvinist.
Do you refuse to apologize for creating the modern world?"
"I do refuse to apologize for creating the modern world."
And of him earning the Proud Boys' second degree. To do that, members have to list the names of 5 breakfast cereals while being punched by other Proud Boys. We reached out to Enrique Tarrio for comment. He says Kessler was denied membership shortly after this video was recorded. But according to court records obtained by Insider, Kessler said under oath that he was a member for a couple of months, and he was kicked out after the rally in Charlottesville. In our interview, Enrique Tarrio told us white supremacists are not his problem.
"I'll be honest with you. People with those views are allowed to hold those views. They should hold those views. Do I think it's stupid? Yes, I think it's stupid. But, like, who am I to police someone's thought? You get me? As long as they're not hurting anybody, let them do whatever they want. It's not my problem."
In the last decade, right-wing extremists have been responsible for the majority of terrorist attacks and attempted attacks in the United States. And last October, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security said it expects racially and ethnically motivated violent extremists to remain the most persistent and lethal threat in the United States.
And this is why it's hard to detect groups like the Proud Boys, because you're not going to be looking for the type of extremism that comes wrapped in the American flag.
What would you say to reports that members of the Proud Boys are violent? You were saying before it's always in self-defense.
Mm-hmm.
Is it always in self-defense?
It's always been in self-defense. I always ask this. I never get an answer. I'm dying for somebody to give me a pointed question or a pointed incident where the Proud Boys either initiated a fight or instigated a fight to happen.
Well, I have one for you. So two Proud Boys were sentenced for 4 years in prison last year for attacking left-wing protesters.
In 2018, Gavin McInnes spoke at the Metropolitan Republican Club in New York City. A group of Proud Boys got in a fight with some anti-fascist protesters outside the building.
They said it was in self-defense, but the New York Times obtained security footage that shows they started the attack.
There's two Proud Boys sitting in prison for 4 years for defending themselves. And there's nothing that anybody is going to do to make me apologize for defending ourselves.
Tario says he doesn't believe the Proud Boys started it, and he thinks they were unfairly prosecuted. But at their sentencing in 2019, a New York State Supreme Court judge compared their actions to what was going on in Nazi Germany during the 1930s. Facebook and Instagram banned the Proud Boys organization from their platforms, and they took down Gavin McInnes' accounts. And then McInnes announced he was leaving the Proud Boys, the group he started. Enrique Tarrio ran to replace him. He says he was voted in unanimously.
We've never changed direction. We've never changed what we're about. But we've kind of become, I guess, a symbol of fighting back. Because up until that point, conservatives weren't fighting back.
Under Tarrio's leadership, the Proud Boys have taken it upon themselves to jump to President Trump's defense around the country. They've marched in Sacramento, Kalamazoo, Washington, D.C., and Portland. And at every stop, Tarrio wore a bulletproof vest and said the same thing. We are not the aggressors. We're here to protect Americans.
The truth is that this is all about love. Love for each other and love for our country.
And that is how the Proud Boys ended up on the biggest stage in America, the first presidential debate. More than 73 million people were watching.
So what are you saying?
I'm willing to do anything. I want to see peace.
Then do it, sir.
Say it. Do you want to call them? What do you want to call them? Give me a name.
White supremacists and right-wing Proud Boys.
Stand back and stand by. But I'll tell you what. Somebody's got to do something about Antifa and the left, because this is not a right-wing problem.
This is a left-wing problem.
It was a gift to the Proud Boys. Before the debate, Tarrio says his chapter in Florida had less than 200 members.
And we have right now sitting in the application process, we have about 700 to 800 members that are trying to join. So I kind of want to thank Joe Biden for that. You know, I think his mention on the debate stage opened a lot of people's eyes.
Today, Tarrio says the Proud Boys have more than 20,000 members worldwide. But some experts think the real number is probably much, much lower. Since the election, many members of the group have refused to accept Trump's loss. Hundreds of them showed up in Washington, D.C. for the Million MAGA March and Stop the Steal protest. And 2 weeks before the inauguration, Enrique Tarrio was arrested as part of an FBI investigation into individuals with intentions to cause violence at the Capitol on January 6th. He was carrying two high-capacity firearm magazines, which he told officers he was returning to a customer. He was charged for this and an unrelated offense. The day after he was released, some Proud Boys participated in the attempted coup at the Capitol building.
Let's get in there! Let's go! Come on!
This is the people's house!
Tarrio told Insider he was not in D.C. during the siege. But earlier that week, an account on the social media platform Parler, with a username linked to Tarrio, posted that the Proud Boys would turn out in record numbers. During and after the siege, the same Parler account made posts that seemed to applaud the attempted coup and support the insurrectionists. But even after Tarrio's arrest,
so I want to start by saying that there is a content warning for this. This is very racist
It is homophobic. There is anti-Semitic content. But it is important that we talk about it. So if anybody needs to take a break, leave, please feel free to do so. So up until about 2 weeks ago, I was going to talk to you about a totally different topic. I was going to come here and talk about my memories as being a young person and how I felt like issues that were so important to me were only passively interesting to adults, and they had no interest in solving them. And I was going to talk to you about how I was using my privilege as an adult to address the issues that young people today are calling our attention to and ask you to take action on them. And you should. Different topic for a different day. But on April 27th, 2 weeks ago, the last day of Passover, a white nationalist murdered another American in a terrorist attack. And I knew that I could not get up here tonight and talk about anything else than that. I also knew that we have to talk about a new emergent strategy to fight white nationalist terrorism, because is it a danger to our country? It is dangerous to us, and it is dangerous to our world. I want to define a few words for you. White supremacy is the belief that white people are superior to people of color and therefore should be dominant over them. It's a very stupid belief. White nationalism, then, is the belief that there should be a white identity, a white nation identity. They could all be together on their own. Also stupid. Just like a drunk person does not have to, in fact, believe that they are drunk to be drunk, white nationalists do not have to believe they are white nationalists in order to be white nationalists. Just like Christian Picciolini, who left the white supremacy movement and started a group, Life After Hate, said, white supremacists do not believe they're white supremacists. In fact, they would deny it to this day. But yes, they are part of white supremacy groups. So before we go into all of this, I want to say that I am an ascriber to the No Notoriety campaign, which asks that the media not share or name those who commit mass violence because it encourages others to commit mass violence. So I will be describing things that have happened. I will be telling you about white nationalist terrorist events in the United States, but I will not be telling you the names of people who committed them, and I will not be showing you their pictures. I will be naming public officials and elected officials who traffic in white nationalism whose comments are public. So since Twitter introduced the bookmark function, I have found myself bookmarking tweets that I didn't really have a use for. I'm not rereading them, I'm not retweeting them, I'm not sharing them with anybody, I'm not bringing up the information at happy hours or dinner parties. And up until 2 weeks ago, I honestly did not know why I was saving these tweets of white nationalist murders that were happening in our nation in this library on Twitter. I felt like a crazy person. Seeing all of these things come across my Twitter feed, I was saving them thinking, okay, well, somebody's going to make the connection. Somebody's going to raise the alarm. I thought I was crazy for thinking this, but I am not. White nationalist terrorism is here. It is real, and it is a very growing problem. Globally, terrorist attacks are declining. In the United States, it's going up. And this is due to white nationalist terrorism. What terrorism looks like in the United States is white nationalism. There have been 172 incidents of white nationalist terrorism from 2002 to 2009. That's not murders. That's number of incidents. Here's what that looks like in the United States. If you add in terror attacks or plots, it looks like this. There's 205. You add in white supremacist incidences, like ones that happen in Minneapolis, you go up to 387. And this map is only current through February of this year, so it leaves out incidents like what happened in Poway, California. So I'm going to walk you through a little bit of the timeline. But I also want to talk to you about incidents you've heard of that you might associate with white nationalism, like the 9 people who were murdered in Charleston. They were murdered at a Bible study in June of 2015. You also might have heard of hate crimes that happen, like when a former KKK Grand Wizard, who was very active online and called for a genocide against Jews, murdered 3 Jews at a community center. It's a hate crime. Then there's other ones that we associate with a violent incident. And even though there's publicly available information about the perpetrator's white supremacy ideology, it is totally overlooked. So in the case of the Marjory Stoneman Douglas shooter, we know that he talked about killing Mexicans, keeping black people in chains and cutting their necks, that he hated black people because they were black, hated Jews because they thought wanted to destroy the world, and wanted to shoot gay people in the head. And then there's other ones that get swept under the rug or just become this one-off thing that happens. In Minneapolis in 2015, five demonstrators outside of the 4th Precinct were shot by white supremacists. And if you read it, it says racially motivated. Even though they posted videos days before the shooting that they were white supremacists, they encouraged people to stay white and filmed themselves with guns before they shot up protesters. I'm not going to walk through all 172 instances, but I'll name some. In 2009, a security guard at the Holocaust Memorial Museum was shot and killed by a white supremacist. In 2012, six Wisconsin worshipers were murdered in their Sikh temples by a white supremacist. In 2015, we had the Charleston terrorist attack. We also had the Minneapolis white supremacist shooting. In 2016, the FBI thwarted a bomb attack by two white supremacists who wanted to start a race war. 2017, we saw the murder of Timothy Common. We had two men who were stabbed in Portland. We had the Unite the Right rally where Heather Heyer was murdered and dozens of others were injured. Here in Minnesota, we had the Bloomington Mosque bombing where three men drove from Illinois to bomb a mosque here in our state. And it's interesting because at the time, people wanted to get really specific about what kind of white supremacists they were. They were a white supremacist militia. They were white supremacists. 2018, we saw the murder of Blaise Bernstein, the Jeffersontown Kroger shooting where two senior citizens were murdered while shopping for groceries after the gunman was denied entrance to a synagogue. And we had the Tree of Life shooting. 2019, we saw the FBI thwart a white homeland mass murder plot. We had the burning of three black churches. We had a Minnesota National Guard member who had his papers recalled because of his extensive involvement in white nationalist groups. And recently we had the Poway Synagogue shooting. I want to pause there, because that's heavy. That's a lot. And I don't know if all of you or any of you have ever linked all of these together in your mind before, but if this is the first time that that has happened, it's hard to sit with. That's its own problem, that if no one's ever linked it together. But realizing that we have a problem here is quite possibly the first step that none of us have taken. And I hope we take that step tonight. I know that for the majority of my lifetime, terrorism has always been a thing that other people deal with. It happens in other countries. The military deals with it, the CIA deals with it, law enforcement deals with it. There's not much I can do. That is different. There is a lot we can do. So even though we're sitting with this heavy realization, I want you to know that there is a lot of power that we hold as people, as citizens of this country, to make things different. So what do we do? The first thing that we can know is that words matter. White nationalist terrorists are terrorists, and we have to name them as such. I want to point out a lot of different ways that white nationalist terrorists are talked about. They're gunmen. Anti-Semitic shootings, hate crimes, they're terrorists. I want to specifically draw your attention to the murder of the Sikh folks in Wisconsin. Even though the perpetrator had skulls and crossbones on his forearm with the word suffer, he had white supremacist tattoos on his arms and legs, he had 838, which is a coded symbol for skinheads and white supremacists that have been committed to a number of murders, and he had the number 14 circled on his arm, which corresponds to, we must secure the existence of our people for a future for our white children. And despite this, reports had to say he had no drugs in his system. He acted alone. And the FBI said there was no evidence that because of his connection to white supremacist groups, did he shoot six Sikh people in their temple? There have been people who have been warning of this problem since 2009. In 2009, there was a report put out by the Department of Homeland Security under the Obama administration calling our attention to what was happening. But consistently, our government has done nothing. In an era of policy platforms that see things like 100% renewable energy and thousands of miles of walls and reparations and free college, it is wild to me that elected officials on both sides of the aisles have yet to put forth a real policy solution to deal with white nationalist terrorists. And I will call myself out too, because I did a resolution in the State House. A resolution doesn't get us anywhere. We need very real solutions, and we need our elected officials to do that. Right now, we don't even collect data about the crimes, the murders, the instances of white nationalist terrorism in America. And if we don't even know the breadth and scope of the problem, we can't even get real about making a solution. Right now, the data collection falls to groups like the Anti-Defamation League and the Southern Poverty Law Center and colleges and universities who have thankfully been trying to keep their arms around this. But if we don't actually collect real data, we'll never make real solutions. I mentioned the report from 2009, and what happened at the time was it came out from the Obama administration. It talked about right-wing extremism, and it also talked about the vulnerability that returning military members had to being recruited by extremists. And it was called out as being an attack on conservative ideals. And they were forced to apologize to a whole bunch of people. The task force were dismantled. The funding went away. And there was nobody working in Department of Homeland Security on domestic terrorism by 2010. The Obama administration did create the Countering Violent Extremism Program that was ostensibly to deal with violent extremism in all forms, but it was very much focused on Muslims. And under the current administration, that focus has only narrowed and sharpened and become much more explicit about Muslims. In fact, there were few grants that were granted to organizations working against white nationalist terrorism right before the end of the previous administration that were canceled with the incoming of this administration. Acting in the face of terrorism should not be an issue for the United States of America. We have done it before, and we are great at it. At the very least, we should open a white nationalist-inspired terrorism case like we did for Islamic violent homegrown extremists. And this would allow the FBI to dedicate resources, coordinate with local law enforcement, and collect real data. But most importantly, we have to support community groups who are working with their own communities to combat hate. We have ample tools at our disposal, including people who have been part of these movements that have left. And I'm not going to get into all of the reasons why people are white supremacists. There are a lot of reasons. The people who have been there are most equipped to help people leave. It's isolation, it's hate speech that is facilitated online, it's loneliness, and on and on and on. I don't have all the solutions, and we don't have all the time, but the people who have been doing this work do. Defunding their efforts is not helping. So one of the other pieces that we can do is we can use our social collective power. In addition to our government and elected officials, companies, corporations, social media platforms, they facilitate a lot of this, whether wittingly or unwittingly. Thankfully, white supremacists, white nationalists have been increasingly deplatformed, although they're creating their own platforms to spread their hate speech. But their money, though becoming increasingly fewer, is still coming to them. They are creating tax-exempt charities within the United States, not paying taxes, and still raising money that the IRS is allowing them to do. We also have organizations or companies like MasterCard that are still right now making money off of the payments that people are making to white nationalist groups. I'm sure there are MasterCard holders in this room. You have the collective power to force a company that you patronize to do something different. We cannot have a conversation about white nationalist terrorism without talking about social media. Almost all of us use social media, and it's time that we wield our collective power so that these platforms regulate the activity of terrorists and counter online extremism. There's been a sustained effort to get platforms like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and YouTube to curb this content, but where they have been very successful with ISIS, they have been much less willing to do that with white nationalists. A recent study found that in the same amount of time where they had 4,000 ISIS accounts and roughly the same amount of white nationalist accounts, 1,100 ISIS accounts were suspended and like 4 white supremacist ones were suspended. This is the disparity with which they're being treated. A researcher says that we haven't seen comparable pressure for platforms to go after white violence because companies often face political blowback from the right. So this is where it gets a little bit uncomfortable, because
part of the reason there has been less pressure is because the reality is white supremacists are much closer to and sometimes in control of the levers of power in the United States. Recently, there was an article that came out that talked about Twitter won't treat white nationalists like ISIS because it meant banning some Republican elected officials, too. Combating white nationalism should not and cannot be a partisan issue. It has to be something that everyone is worried about. And while white nationalists are in no way championing conservative causes and ideals, I can tell you that, they are coordinated and working to infiltrate a major U.S. political party. That is a stated, open goal that they have. Public officials at the highest level of government have openly trafficked in white national rhetoric with little to no consequence. There have been far too many current and former members of this administration that have direct ties to white supremacists. We should not be comfortable with this. White House Chief Speaker Darren Beatty attended a white nationalist conference and gave a speech. Among attendees was Richard Spencer. Carl Higbee trafficked in white nationalism, calling the black race having lax morals, and added that black women think breeding is a form of government employee. The special assistant to the Secretary of the Interior posted this meme on her Facebook. The Center for Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships, the man who ran that said that the black community is responsible for turning cities into ghettos and slums, and that the only contribution Islam has ever made to society is oil and dead bodies. You have things like Representative Steve King, who is unsure why white nationalist and white supremacist language is bad, and on and on. The uncomfortable truth that America has been unwilling to reconcile with is that our history is built on white supremacy. I named for you that the definition of white supremacy is that white people are superior to people of color and therefore should be dominant over them. To ignore that that is our history is to ignore literally all of our history. To pretend like people who came to this country didn't call Native American people who were already here savages, who were lacking the intelligence, the industry, the moral habits, or the desire for improvement for any favorable change in their condition. Amidst another superior race, and without appreciating their inferiority or seeking to control them, they must necessarily yield to the force of circumstances and ire long disappear. This is Andrew Jackson. We export white nationalism, and we have been. Hitler looked to the United States of America when creating borders and policies throughout the Holocaust. The fundamental and external escapable difference exists between races, President Harding said. Racial amalgamation there cannot be. He'd be really disappointed that I exist. If we don't acknowledge our history with big things like when black soldiers came back from World War II and had access to the GI Bill and banks wouldn't lend to them and there were no mortgages and colleges and universities didn't let them in, that's real and it has lasting effects. And little things like talking about Thomas Jefferson's mistress, Sally Hemings, as if she wasn't an enslaved woman who was repeatedly raped by the person who owned her. It is important that we know our history, because if we don't know our history, we cannot go forward and change. Reconciliation has often been a tool that countries use to make sure that they never repeat their past. We made Germany do it after the Holocaust. South Africa did the same thing. America never has. And it is the ground in which we allow white supremacist ideology and ultimately terrorists to thrive. So we can't keep pretending that people who are trafficking in white nationalism aren't doing it. It's not partisan to call it out. We're trying to make a difference. Too often we wait for the most extreme rhetoric to say that that is bad. No more. When people talk about massive demographic changes threatening our country, they are trafficking in white nationalism. When people call immigrants invaders, they are trafficking in white nationalism. When they warn of replacement or white genocide, they are trafficking in white nationalism. So, what do we do from here? How can you be hopeful after this entire long presentation? Do you guys remember when you were going to go back to school? And you'd be like, okay, this year, I'm going to do all of my homework, I'm going to write all of my papers, I'm going to show up to class every day.
But what we see in those chats is very explicit plans to, as they put it, hunt anti-fascists. Very explicit plans to procure mission, I guess is the right word, like pellets for these guns that would do the maximum damage, glass pellets, or should we freeze them? Can we get pellets that contain gas? Very explicit discussions about weaponry, about how to do the most damage, and what I would call incitement to homicide.
One day, all of the facts in about 30 years' time will be published.
When genocide has been carried out in this country almost with impunity, and when it is near to completion, people talk about intervention.
They will be met with fire, fury, and frankly power, the likes of which this world has never seen before.
Welcome to Angry Planet. I'm Matthew Galt.
And I'm Jason Steele.
What's the difference between a Proud Boy and a Boogaloo Boy? Are Patriot Prayer and Patriot Front the same thing? If I wear a Hawaiian shirt while eating a bowl of Lucky Charms, does that make me a member of a far-right group? How many of these tactical bearded weirdos are there really, and are they dangerous? If it feels like the world today is weirder, wilder, and grosser than the one in the past, I feel you. 2020 has seen an explosion of far-right groups, and if you find it hard to keep track of all of them, you're not alone. Luckily, our guest today has been keeping track of many of them. So here to help us order and sort the Proud Boy from the Boogaloo is Jason Wilson. Wilson is an independent journalist whose work has appeared in The Guardian and Bellingcat. Jason, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on one of my favorite podcasts.
That is so nice to hear. Thank you. Obviously, we were talking a little bit before we started recording, but we had discussed talking about taxonomy of the different far right groups and linking it to the John Birch Society about a week ago. We were going to talk, and we're recording this on October 1st now, a couple of days after the first presidential debate. And one of those groups was called out during the presidential debate. So I think it would be we have to talk about that. So you've been following this a lot. I think you literally published something with The Guardian right before we got on the air about this group. Who or what are the Proud Boys, and why were they being talked about during the presidential debate?
The Proud Boys are it's best to just cut to the chase now and say they're a kind of shirt movement, I think, and there are parallels between them and the shirt movements that were seen in various countries around the world in the interwar period. So they call themselves a men's fraternity, a drinking club. They call themselves Western chauvinists. And they were formed by Gavin McInnes, who was a founder of Vice, has long since left, and is now a fairly fringe conservative media figure since he's been deplatformed and thrown off a number of social media services and also CRTV. He was broadcasting on that. But anyway, he got this group together and they do drink together. Just a couple of weeks back, they were in Las Vegas for their annual West Fest. But the reason that they're of such concern to people is that they're also fond of violent confrontations with the left in American cities. And in particular, in the city where I'm based, the city of Portland, Oregon, over the entirety, really, of the Trump administration, we've seen Proud Boys coming into town and getting into fights with anti-fascists. Yeah, they have been, the story I published this morning is based on the Blue Leaks trove. I pulled some stuff out of that, and your listeners may have heard of that. That's a rather large data breach associated with the Fusion Center that happened in June of this year. And what I found in there was that a number of agencies, including fusion centers, which are they're a national network of state-based information sharing type institutions that put federal, local, tribal, state agencies together and put them all in the loop with the same information. And they're part of the country's counterterrorism infrastructure. Anyhow, I found fusion centers, local police agencies, federal agencies, all talking about the Proud Boys in terms of they're a white supremacist group, they're an extremist group. There was an advertisement for law enforcement training in Orange County, California, where they were being, you know, treated as a gang and thought about as a gang along the same lines as the Hammerskins or the Rise Above movement. There are a lot of agencies taking these guys really seriously as a violent extremist group. Yeah, and look, what happened on Tuesday night at the debate came after they had mobilized nationally to descend once again on the city of Portland. So they had a rally in Portland on the weekend at a park on the city's northern fringe. They were originally going to come downtown, but they changed the venue, possibly to take it off federal property where it was originally scheduled to take place. And possibly also they may have been told by various agencies that it would be preferable for them to do something less confrontational. In any case, that was in response to a homicide that happened in downtown Portland on the 29th of August, when a guy called Aaron Danielson, who was a member of another group, Patriot Prayer, who's another right-wing street fighting group here in the area, where he was shot dead by a gentleman who identified as an anti-fascist, as Antifa, and that his admitted killer was later himself on the 3rd of September shot dead by police. So I guess I would say that the Proud Boys have been integral to this cycle we've seen in Portland over the entirety, really, of the Trump administration, where local right-wing activists engage in incursions because mostly they're not actually from Portland. They're from outlying parts of the metropolitan area or parts of small town Washington and Oregon. We've had incursions by them into the city, acts of provocation. Eventually, at some time in the summer, this results in some kind of catastrophic or heinous act of violence. And then national Republican politicians get involved, national groups like the Proud Boys get involved, and then they stage this kind of spectacular sort of intervention into the situation, and Proud Boys will come into town from all over the country. That's the immediate view to the president's remarks, probably what was on Joe Biden's mind, the reason that he raised it. But yeah, the Proud Boys are not only integral to events in the city of Portland, but they've really been a consistent element of the kinds of street confrontations and contentious rallies that we've seen in the country throughout the last 4 or 5 years.
What are we talking about when we're talking about numbers? Because what I've read was the rally in Portland was something of a damp squib. Only a couple hundred people showed up. How does that compare with their actual numbers?
Yeah, that, as you say, they only really, my estimate was around 350, but that would include locals and media. There was a lot of media here, a disproportionate amount of media possibly. But yeah, let's say they had a couple of hundred. I think the biggest crowd I've ever seen the right bring to Portland was probably in August 2018, when it would have been something like 500 or 600, mostly Proud Boys. In terms of their national numbers, it's probably not correct to describe it as a mass organization. I would imagine it's somewhere in the four figures and maybe not even the high four figures. I would say there's probably several thousand of them throughout the country. The problem is, though, if enough of them descend on your town, and there's something particular about Portland, I think, about its size. It's not the biggest city, so that they can have a disproportionate impact here in terms of a disruption. But yeah, I would say it's several thousand. I didn't mention some basics initially either. They're identifiable by, they wear black Fred Perry polo shirts with gold fringes on the collar. And last week, actually, the Fred Perry company said they would no longer be selling those shirts in the United States because of their association with the Proud Boys. So they also tend to wear red Trump hats. And there are people in the organization, like one of the de facto leaders now, I guess, Joe Biggs, who are military veterans. There have been some instances where serving police officers have found to be involved with the group. And in fact, one in Vancouver, Washington, which is just over the Columbia River from Portland and effectively part of the metro area, a deputy there was fired several years back because she was involved in the Proud Girls, which I guess is the women's auxiliary organization, when she was selling merchandise associated with that group. The numbers aren't huge, but if they can concentrate those numbers in a city like Portland, they can cause some real problems. I think the worst incident, I reported on Charlottesville for The Guardian, and obviously that was a terrible day because of the homicide, the vehicular homicide that happened at the end. But in terms of the street fighting, Charlottesville was not as bad, in my opinion, as what happened on the 30th of June 2018 in Portland, where they had a kind of pitched battle with anti-fascists in the streets that police totally lost control of. And that day, your listeners can find video of that day. I saw 6, 7, 8 people attacking someone prone on the ground, Proud Boys attacking anti-fascists who'd fallen on the ground. There was an infamous kind of punch thrown by a guy who goes by Rufio Pan Man in the movement, where he struck this resounding blow to an anti-fascist who was lifted off their feet and then sprawled on the ground. And that moment became a huge recruiting tool for this group. But yeah, that was a terrible day. And I think another terrible day was this year on the 22nd of August, when a number of Proud Boys and associated people came into the downtown area and they were shooting paintball pellets directly and indiscriminately in a crowd of leftist protesters. One journalist, Robert Evans, who I actually have written with, he had his hand broken by a Proud Boy with a folding baton that day. It was an extremely violent day, and they also destroyed a snack van that had been catering to protesters downtown. So that was a very bad day as well. And people who, I didn't actually cover that one, but people who were there also compared that day to Charlottesville and said it was maybe a more dangerous situation because, you know, there were guns drawn and stuff. So this movement is all about violence, really. There are degrees of membership in the group, and the details there, some of them are silly. One of the degrees involves getting beaten up by other Proud Boys when you try to recite the names of breakfast cereal. But the fourth degree of membership nuanced the language around that. But it used to be explicitly that you had to engage in violence and carry out an act of violence in the course of movement act. The language now is more euphemistic. It's something about sacrificing something for the movement, but everyone knows what it means. And so you had this situation, especially in 2017 and 2018, where you had guys coming to cities like Portland so they could get their fourth degree. So yeah, it's a movement that's all about violence. I don't lightly compare it to the shirt movements of Central Europe in between the wars. It's a very similar kind of purpose, which is a kind of, they see themselves as political enforcers and they're personally loyal to the president. They explicitly define themselves as a pro-Trump group. And look, while their stated politics on their website and stuff may not be seem extremist in the context of Republican politics in 2020, the preparedness to use violence, I think, is what defines them as an extremist group. And yeah, I think they're capable of enormous disruption and enormous harm if they're able to concentrate their numbers in a particular way, just because of their fondness for violence.
Will you define for the audience what a shirt movement is?
Oh, sure. Yeah. The most famous probably are the black shirts associated with Italian fascism, and then the brown shirts or the SAE associated with Nazism in Germany. And those groups, we look for a lot of the time, the discussions about, there have been discussions obviously about whether President Trump is a kind of fascist leader. And they often get bogged down in details about ideology. If you read scholarship on interwar fascism, the exotic theories of race really aren't necessary to defining fascism. All necessary is this kind of eliminationist idea about some kind of national enemy. Italian fascism, until a long way into the war, was not violently anti-Semitic in the same way that Hitlerism was. But what they did do was go around trying to find leftists to beat up. And that was effectively what the black shirts did ahead of Mussolini seizing power. They defined the national enemy as socialists and other leftists. And they went around beating them up. the mass politics of the 1920s and 1930s were very different to the politics of today. Those societies, for one thing, were much younger, just in terms of the average age of the people who lived in them. And the spectacle of mass gatherings was a big part of that politics. So things have changed slightly. And I'm not saying that, you know, the Proud Boys exist on a scale that the Black Shirts did in fascist Italy. But it's a very similar purpose and a very similar ethos. And it's not the kind of thing that you want to get out of control, let get out of control in any society, I don't think. So they're effectively a paramilitary or militia group that's dedicated to street fighting with the perceived enemies of their movement and their leader.
I'm wondering about how these new groups, when you mention militias, relatively new groups, I guess, how they match up against, let's say, the Michigan militia of the late 90s, Timothy McVeigh and his groups, the groups allied with his ideology, the Freemen in Montana. Are these guys descendants of those movements?
I think that they are conscious, in some cases, modification of that 90s militia moment. There are certainly common elements. If you look at members of the Boogaloo movement or members of decentralized kind of militia movements like the Three Percenters, if you look at the Oath Keepers, yes, there is this idea that the Second Amendment is sacred and that it's that the right to bear arms is under threat from left of center politicians in particular. There is a strong basis in other kinds of conspiracy theories. There is a sort of fundamentalist and idiosyncratic reading of the Constitution. And there is an idea that the federal government has usurped powers that more properly belong to either the states or even to figures like the local sheriff. But I think the difference is that the 90s militias were much more politically and socially marginal than the people who are involved in these movements now. In a very profound sense, all of that stuff has become much more mainstream, especially if you look at right-wing politics. I would encourage you and your listeners to go back and look at, you can find on YouTube the hearings that were held by a congressional committee, I forget which one, but during the 90s in the wake of that militia movement. And they were looking into this phenomenon in the wake of both Waco and then the bombing in Oklahoma City. And Republicans are clearly, the Republican members of the committee are clearly trying to distance themselves from these guys and are clearly actually genuinely appalled by some of the things that the militia groups have done. You're not going to find, look at the Kyle Rittenhouse situation, you're not going to find Republicans reflexively distancing themselves from these groups now. And look, I think if we look at the origins of the Oath Keepers and the origins of the Three Percenters, they both spring up really late in the 2000s, so 2008, 2009, and they're really most immediately a response to the election of President Barack Obama. So these kind of armed groups have been basically dormant for various reasons throughout the Bush administration, partly because they thrive on opposition to the federal government, partly because the war on terror was a kind of all-encompassing thing that didn't leave a lot of room on the right flank in some instances for these movements to spring up. And partly, there's other details as well, though a lot of these guys were discredited by how much they invested in the Y2K idea and how that was going to almost end society, and they were encouraging people to prepare for that, and then nothing happened, and you had that kind of when prophecy fails type moment where, you know, people drifted away. But then when Obama was elected, you had a response that on the right that took a number of forms. One was the Tea Party movement, and one was these kind of militias who, like their predecessors, were concerned about a federal government overreach now that a Democrat was in the White House. And I think that what happened was that there was a lot of cross-pollination between a radicalizing Republican Party that you saw in the form of like the Tea Party movement, a radicalizing Republican grassroots anyway, an increasing stridency in conservative media in response to President Obama, and these militia movements. There was a lot of cross-pollination, and a lot of the bright lines that may have been there in the 1990s was erased. And I would say that now, because of the work, I don't like to say too much about exactly where I live, but I would say I'm close to the edges of the metro, and so there are rural areas nearby. Now it's nothing for me to see a pickup truck go by with a 3%er's decal on it. Far from being a marginal, radical fringe that even most conservatives reject, the 3%er's idea has become almost like a right-wing lifestyle brand at this point. And there is just not the same level of immune response on the right to these radical currents. And so you had that guy who was drafted into the NFL who had a 3%er's tattoo, and that was all a big, there was a big fuss about that. I'm sure you remember that was earlier this year. I'll find the guy's name and send it to you. Maybe you can put it in the show notes. But anyway, a guy was drafted to the NFL. He had the 3%er's tattoo, and there was a fuss about this. And the guy just didn't seem to realize that this might be a problem. And I think the reason for that is that this logo of a militia group has become just now reduced to a symbol almost of, not reduced, sorry. The logo of this militia group has now become disseminated so widely that it's now, it indicates just a kind of support for the Second Amendment or a kind of authentic conservatism. So yeah, things have gotten mixed up. And the Rittenhouse situation, where Kyle Rittenhouse, you'll remember, he was a 17-year-old kid. He traveled interstate to Kenosha, Wisconsin, and shot three people and killed two who he, again, perceived were his enemies or the enemies of law and order. And now he's in significant legal trouble. But I think that whereas once conservatives might have at least been relied on to condemn lawbreakers who claim to be acting in their name, this kid raised $1 million in crowdfunding to support his legal expenses and has been lauded across conservative media, including Fox News, as someone who is trying to do the right thing and defend his community. It's a much more dangerous moment in some ways than the 1990s, because there isn't, I don't think, that response. And I said the Tea Party represented a radicalization of the Republican grassroots. Robert Evans and I did a story a week or so back, both for The Guardian, and we did a version for Bellingcat, a longer version, that we got leaked some chats where people were planning ahead of these protests in Portland, and they were explicitly planning violence.
What was the name of that group? Because I think that's an important kind of context for that particular story, because it's a separate network of people than like the Proud Boys and the 3%er's, etc. There may be some like overlapping there, but it's a distinct entity, correct?
Right. It's just called the Patriots Coalition, the Oregon Patriots Coalition. Yeah. And look, some of those people are familiar presences at rallies and have been violent before. Some of them aren't, but they don't define themselves in terms of any exotic ideology. They don't have a ton of ideological commitments, and they just describe themselves as patriots and Trump supporters. And that's the concern at this point, that the people who are not, you know, subscribing to the kind of radical ideological positions that we saw in the 1990s militia movement, these radical perspectives on the Constitution or the right to bear arms or the idea that the United Nations is going to displace American sovereignty. Some of them might be believers in conspiracy theories like QAnon, for sure, but that's not the basis of their organizing. The basis of their organizing is that they're Trump supporters, and that people protesting against the president or even the police are somehow enemies of the nation, national enemies. That's the concern, that millions of people have been radicalized in this way over the last 4 or 5 years.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the chat logs that you and Robert have uncovered, what they said and what the general thrust of that group was?
Yeah, they were discussing planning. They were planning for rallies. So to give you a little more context, there have been now, I think as of last night, there have been 115 nights of protest in Portland. There was a brief, very brief, 1 or 2 night respite when we had the wildfires come through. But basically, ever since the George Floyd protests began nationally, there's been one every night in Portland. Now, mostly the far, especially early on, you didn't have far right groups coming in to confront those protesters. And I think they were just simply too large, and they didn't want to counter protest such a large, you know, crowd. However, from around mid-August, you did start to get groups of far right folks coming into town to confront, disrupt these protesters. Now, the imprimatur for those counter-protests came from pro-police groups here. I've also written about them. There's one called COPSNW, Cops Northwest, and there's one called Back the Blue PDX. So PDX is an abbreviation for Portland, if listeners don't know that. They started doing little protests in the outer metro area where they weren't opposing people, but then they started also coming into town. And so on the 17th of August, you had an occasion where a bunch of, they were joined by a bunch of people with pellet guns and mace who let loose with that on protesters. And then that also happened on the 22nd. And that was that terribly violent day that I mentioned. Then on the 29th, there was a pro-Trump truck convoy, some members of which strayed from the route that they had agreed on with Portland Police Bureau and drove into the downtown area. And then once again, we saw people shooting at pellet guns at protesters from trucks and spraying them with mace from trucks. And we saw them driving their trucks at people. And that was actually the night that homicide happened. So that's like the context for not only that homicide, but these are also the events that these folks were discussing. And they were also discussing attending the rally that happened on Saturday. And in fact, some of them did attend. Some of the people involved in the chats did attend. But what we see in those chats is very explicit plans to, as they put it, hunt anti-fascists. Very explicit plans to procure munition, I guess is the right word, like pellets for these guns that would do the maximum damage, glass pellets, or should we freeze them? Can we get pellets that contain gas? Very explicit discussions about weaponry, about how to do the most damage, and what I would call incitement to homicide. There was a guy in the chats called Mark Melke, who is a military veteran. He was a captain in the US Army. He claims to have been a combat veteran. I can't find great evidence for that, but he certainly did serve overseas, more in an intelligence and community liaison. He knows a number of languages. I can't find direct evidence that he was actually involved in combat. Nevertheless, I'm sure he's had basic training, and he has been seen leading a militia called 1776 2.0 into the city. Now, he hasn't been recorded or observed actually directly involving himself in violence, but he was the most gung-ho person in the chat, calling for people to solve this problem downtown by killing anti-fascists and suggesting that people should sufficiently disguise their identity so that they couldn't be prosecuted for this if they happened to be caught on a security camera or something like that. But yeah, very explicit, very bloodthirsty discussions about coming into Portland. He lives in Dallas, Oregon, by the way, which is a small town just west of the capital, Salem, maybe 40 or 50 minutes west, southwest of Portland. Yeah, very explicit, very bloodthirsty. And also this sense that they were doing all of this for the president, in support of the president, against those who would oppose the president. Somewhat chillingly, they also, and I'm seeing this out in the open on social networks like Parler, they also had the view that any result other than a Trump victory in November would mean that the election had been rigged, that a Trump victory was more or less inevitable. Any other result would mean that it had been rigged, and that would be the moment where they would have to take up struggle on behalf of the president. And so that's that, plus the kind of a vigilante, armed vigilante activity I saw here during the wildfire emergency, which was entirely powered by social media rumors. In rural areas, people were taking up arms, holding up journalists at gunpoint, carrying out illegal checkpoints. When I see that kind of discussion of November, and then I see that sort of immediate response to social media rumors in rural areas, that's what makes me concerned about November.
Now, there are other groups that are also out there that you've talked about. Just curious what a Boogaloo Boy is. I'm also curious how they came up with such a stupid-ass name, but that's just me.
It's Breakin' 2. How do you're a child of the 80s.
That's just not right.
Have you never seen the Israeli exploitation classic Breakin' 2 Electric Boogaloo, Jason?
I admit that I have not seen the movie. I did see Breakin', I believe, at the time, but I did not come back for the sequel. I'm told it's not great. Anyway, yeah, that's exactly where they got their name. So this idea of the Boogaloo, that was a more generalized meme or internet joke for a really long time, that a repeat of something would have that electric Boogaloo phrase tacked on the end. But Robert and I, again, wrote in depth about this for Bellingcat and wrote a related article about militia groups for The Guardian. I guess this was back in May when this thing was really taking off. So on the 4chan has a number of boards. One of them is K, which is the weapons board. And a lot of this stuff seems to have originated there. And that was one of the places where the prospect of a civil war in America was constantly and obsessively discussed. And a common view was that this would come about as a result of an attempt to confiscate people's firearms. And I've got to say that belief is also really widely held on the right, as is the belief that if mass confiscation were attempted, that would be the thing that would actually unite all parts of the political right in a kind of a struggle. So that's why you had the Christchurch shooter saying that part of his objective was to actually bring about gun restrictions in the United States, which would lead to a kind of uprising against a liberal democratic government. So anyway, that was a place where it was obsessively discussed. And then a lot of that then moved to Facebook. And any movement, any of these movements that can be on Facebook will be on Facebook for as long as they can, because Facebook is an absolutely superb engine for building a political movement. And we've seen them use it time and time again. QAnon have used it with remarkable effectiveness as well. So anyway, they moved over to Facebook. A lot of this stuff moved over to Facebook throughout 2018 and 2019. And they developed this distinctive aesthetic. And to the extent that Facebook did crack down on this stuff, they developed encoded versions of the Boogaloo idea. One was the Big Igloo, which just simply sounds similar, or the Big Luau. And so that's where the Hawaiian shirts come from, the idea of the Big Luau, where a luau is also a place where you might have roast pork. And so a thing to know about this movement is that, at least in its rhetoric, it's absolutely insurrectionary. And unlike more authoritarian groups like the Oath Keepers, who will have thin blue line patches on their clothes and often are, at least they try to recruit from serving police officers or former police officers, the Boogaloo movement was absolutely anti-police and was, I would describe it for the most part, the main part of the movement, as a kind of insurrectionary libertarianism, insurrectionary right-wing libertarianism. So pro-Second Amendment, pro-First Amendment, pro-Second Amendment to the extent that they really thought that citizens should be able to have rocket launchers and tanks and anything that the government has, one of them told me, anything that the government has, we should be able to have. And he stopped short of saying that people should have nuclear weapons, but he thought...
Yeah, let's see them fly an F-35.
Hell, we can't fly an F-35.
Or maybe the F-35 can't fly, but that's a different story.
Well, yeah, they're absolutely, again, opposed to what they call the Alphabet Boys, people from the alphabet agencies, and in particular, the ATF. And we saw the results of that a few months back when a guy called Stephen Carrillo actually killed two law enforcement officers, one Federal Protective Services officer in Oakland, and then a sheriff's deputy who was looking for him. They're absolutely, again, mostly rhetorically, but obviously there are going to be people on the fringes of this who are going to take this stuff seriously. And there's been a number of terror plots which have an anti-police dimension uncovered now that related to the Boogaloo movement. But anyway, back to my narrative. They moved to Facebook. There was a kind of coming out party for the Boogaloo movement in January when there was a mass protest against new gun laws that were being passed in the state of Virginia. and a number of Boogaloo Boys showed up to that protest, associated with one of the bigger Facebook groups that was associated with the movement. And then coronavirus happened, and coronavirus really exacerbated, at least for a time, every kind of social tension that exists in the country. And it also exacerbated the kind of apocalyptic fantasies of these groups. And so you had a massive surge. Excuse me. I'll say all that again. Coronavirus exacerbated every social tension in the United States, and it exacerbated also the apocalyptic fantasies that really power these groups about social breakdown, the end of the United States, and coming struggle. So they had a kind of surge of interest online, that there was a surge of people joining their groups. There was a kind of stepping up of this rhetoric. There was a ton of evidence of successful co-optation of this whole thing by white supremacists and others who envision a kind of apocalyptic confrontation, but you know, that what they envision is a race war. But it's easy for them to co-opt this kind of this idea and to try and pull people out of this movement into theirs. And that's about when we started writing about it. At some point, not long after that, Facebook actually did start taking this whole thing more seriously and started taking a lot of groups down. And in fact, there are still some there, heavily disguised, but they really didn't, they really did tear the heart out of their presence on Facebook. And I would say now that movement, we saw people in Hawaiian shirts at the early George Floyd protests, but I think the golden age of the Boogaloo movement is probably over. The question is how much damage these movements do while they're going. How many people now have been persuaded that there is an apocalyptic confrontation looming, and that their response to that should be to take up arms and possibly against the government. There's no way to tell. There's no way to tell how many people now have that mindset. There's no way to tell how many people were pulled from that movement into violent white supremacist groups. There's no way to tell how many people have put together a cache of weapons or started training with other people in secret. That's the problem. And that's the problem we had in the 90s as well. It all seems fine until someone blows up a federal building. There's no way to tell what the undercurrents are and what's happening out of view. I would say, too, I look at extremist signs and far-right groups of all kinds. And the thing that I have noticed is that these groups are getting a lot better at operational security. They're always going to have that structural problem where to recruit, they need to do stuff in public, and they need a public presence, including a public presence online. And on the other hand, they want to do stuff that's illegal, so they need to keep that secret. And there's always that structural problem that by recruiting in public, you may attract infiltrators, you may attract law enforcement, and then they may have access to what you're doing in secret. But if you're in a position where